Welcome back to the Huxley Morton podcast, the show where each week we speak to pharma company owners, industry leaders, sharing their stories of personal and professional growth. This week, I have the pleasure of being joined by Steve Wimmer. Steve is the Director of Partnerships at 1N Health. Steve, pleasure to finally get acquainted with yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. Likewise, I feel like we've gone back and forth on LinkedIn. The first time I interacted with you, you shared a meme, and I'm always appreciative of people in the industry who kind of like don't take things so hardcore serious. So quick friends online.
Yes, well, look, that's a big thumbs up for me. People that don't like memes, I would normally can them to be a guest. So you made that hurdle. Look, I typically kick off the show in the same way every time, and that is kind of a bit of a rewind and ask the question as to how did you get into clinical research, I guess.
Yeah. So I listen to a lot of podcasts, and this is a pretty familiar question. And everyone says like, oh, I backed into it. And that is absolutely the truth. Just nowhere near my radar screen really ever until the day that it happened. So I never have had a plan and still don't have a 5-year plan. I don't know what I want to be when I grow up. When I was finishing university, I had a psychology degree, primarily because that was the only thing I could get and graduate on time. Right. And I was debating between long haul trucking, because my dad owned a lumber company growing up, and I just thought the trucks were cool. You can sleep in them and then save up lots of money. And then I had an opportunity to join the staff of like a campus Christian ministry. I was a part of it as a student, and it was pretty impactful for me in terms of changing the direction my life was going. And so I joined that for 10 years and spent 10 years like just kind of hanging out with college students as effectively like a pastor. That wound down and I didn't know what to do next. I was thinking about a PhD in philosophy. I got a master's degree in philosophy during that time, and decided before I go the academic route, what if I just made sure the classroom education is for me? And so I got a job teaching high school students philosophy and hated it. It really came close to crushing my soul. I was super depressed. I'd come home every day. My wife was like, I don't like this version of you.
What was it about that, Steve? Like funny enough, Adam, who's often co-hosting with me, his partner was kind of a high school teacher. I can't remember if it was high school or junior school, but liked it, but had some issues with it. And I think she's now writing a book around it. So yeah, interested to know what the deal was.
Yeah, sure. I've reflected on this a lot over the years. And I think that it comes down to like two primary things. One is expectations. So I was speaking a lot. I was kind of going around college campuses in the Southeast and doing lectures on things like faith and reason. And those are voluntarily attended by college students who kind of would give up part of their Tuesday night to hear this hour-long philosophical lecture. And I thought, like, well, high school students are not that much different than college students. Surely they'll think this is interesting, and I can tone down the academia a little bit and make it cool. Yeah. And that just wasn't the case. They were not at all interested. And then the other piece is just classroom management, discipline, the actual mechanics of being a teacher. I didn't have any of that. So I'm a decent communicator. I think actually pretty good. It's one of the things I count as a strength. But I didn't know how to get a bunch of teenagers to sit still and care about learning about something that didn't naturally appeal to them. So I really think some people are built for certain jobs and some people are really not. And for educating teenagers, I think you need to be built for it. There's a training component, sure, but yeah, it was a grind. I felt constantly disrespected. And even though I was like a cool teacher, I didn't make the connection to transitioning, like being a dude you want to hang out with to like someone you're willing to learn from. So that was tough.
I think it's a weird gig being a teacher. And you're right. There's a certain mold of individual that seems to fit it. My partner's sister does it. And I mean, hats off to anyone who can do it. It's certainly not for me. And I wouldn't say that you necessarily fit the mold. I guess I can normally spot a teacher a mile away. There's certain mannerisms which I'm not always keen on. So like, it's a compliment saying that you don't necessarily fit the mold. But yeah, it's a bit of a unique job, I think.
Yeah, for sure. And I'm going to try and make this as short as possible. It's just a weird winding path. So like during that time, I kind of got in. There was a little revolution in American workwear. during that times, like the 2010s, and I got really into the idea of learning to sew and make my own jeans. And so I taught myself to sew, and I started making stuff out of vintage fabric and just kind of selling it at like markets around town, and put together some branding and tried to do something with it. It never really turned into anything, but a former friend of mine, like, we were connected on Facebook, so he saw me posting about that stuff. We were catching up right after I left teaching and didn't have a plan. I was applying to jobs. No one was calling me back because literally my resume was 12 years of being a professional Christian, which like doesn't really do it for most people. And he asked how teaching was. I said it was not great. I was done and looking for something, applying to marketing jobs. And he said, well, I actually just took a role as a CEO of an e-commerce company. Why don't you come tomorrow, apply, and I'll find something for you. And I was like, okay. So I went over there. I'd had this resume that I thought was very cool. He didn't even look at it. He was just like, all right, here's the three things you could do. Which one do you want to do? And I had no background in e-commerce, no background in marketing. This was basically taking a brand and expanding it from a single product to a line. It was like high-end cleaning products that we were selling online. Totally random. And I took the job and we launched this brand and expanded it from like one product to like 15. And within 12 months, a company approached us about acquiring the brand. So they bought the brand. They wanted me to come to Chicago where their headquarters to manage it. And so I did that and did not love it. So I spent 3 years kind of still doing this e-commerce thing. And then that same friend who had hired me into the e-commerce position called me again and was like, hey, I'm starting something new. I'm taking some of my e-commerce knowledge. I've been working as a consultant in the life sciences industry, and I'm starting a company that does patient recruitment for clinical trials. What do you think about moving back to Orlando? Instead of doing marketing, you're just going to do sales and you have to learn the clinical trials industry. So, and I was just like, again, I have no qualification. So I saw your post the other week, like lampooning kind of those LinkedIn influencer posts that are so high and mighty of like, oh, I hired someone with zero experience. I took a risk and it was the best decision I ever made. And then yours was like jokingly saying they quit after 2 days.
Yeah.
I had no business taking this job. Dan, who is our CEO, is a really big believer in hiring for profile and just trusting that people can adapt. And, I, you know, so far so good. I think I'm like above average at my job. And so I came and moved to Florida and started like researching acronyms and trying to figure out how to talk about clinical research. I remember super early in like maybe the first week, I emailed Kelly McKee, who is pretty well known in the industry. She's part of the CNS. She was at Vertex Pharmaceuticals. I think she's at Medible now or Medidata. Sorry for confusing those two. I'll probably get axed. And we were calling ourselves Precision Subject Recruitment. And she kindly wrote back and was just like, we don't use the word subject, really. It doesn't reflect how patients think of themselves or the value that they bring to research. And I was just like, oh my God, people are responding to my cold email just to school me at how bad I am at this.
I'm not sure if you, I mean, I'm loving this journey so far, Steve. I'm not sure if you saw one of my other posts that I put out the other day about whether anyone's actually asked subjects, whether they like being called subjects. Clearly, Kelly McGee has.
Yeah. She schooled me and I saved that email because I was like, all right, just remember, like, I know a lot about digital marketing, but I don't know anything about this. And keep that attitude at the forefront before I sound like an idiot more. So that was it. So I came down and I joined the company and we really just duct tape and spit and like a bunch of cold outreach and some lucky breaks. And we kept afloat for the first year and a half. And then we've been growing a lot the last 2 years. And really, you know, I don't know if we're segueing into this, but all we do is patient. That's kind of it.
Okay, so that's the company where you are now, 1N Health, it's patient recruitment. And I guess like many people who seem to have fallen into clinical research, it seems that your CEO, Dan, has dragged you into clinical research for the nicer term of the word as it may be, because you are perhaps, I think it's, you know, a very rare breed who can actually pick up jobs and actually perform well at them. But clearly you've done it once to the point where, you know, Dan said, look, I trust in the individual. I'm going to take another punt on him and let him do his thing over here as well. So fair play on that one, Steve. So how long have you now been in the 1N Health gig?
Yeah, so I started in August of 2019. So just before COVID. So coming up on like 4 years in August, so 3.5, I guess.
Yeah,
all with one company doing the same thing.
And in terms of, I guess, so it's patient recruitment, and I've seen your tagline about speeding up clinical trials through, you know, introducing more patients, etc. Talk to me about how patient recruitment works, because it's, I'm assuming, a completely different ballgame to what I do, which is, you know, staffing, job recruitment, whatever phrase you want to put on it, but very much different. I've had people involved with patient recruitment on the show previously, but someone that, as a business that is solely focused on this, how do you go about it, and who are the clients for yourself?
Yeah, I'll go in reverse order. So our clients are typically CROs or sponsors of studies, so either pharma or biotech. Weirdly, like a lot of companies in the space, especially the tech companies who've come out in the last 5 or 10 years, the people who are using our services are the sites, but they're not the buyers. So we have that whole thing hanging over our heads where we have to figure out how to make everyone happy, especially people who are getting a service kind of presented to them that they didn't necessarily choose themselves.
Right.
So, you know, I'll use a little analogy. I know at Huxley Morton, like one of the things you talk about on your site and in your profile is that like you can reach people who otherwise wouldn't be reached because they're not looking for jobs right now. They're not cruising the job boards. They're not doing stuff. You're proactive finding them and saying, hey, what about a change? I think the way we do patient recruitment is very similar. So historically, you have sites, they have these databases and they tap their database and there's the whole feasibility process. We have X amount of people with, you know, type 2 diabetes and a certain percentage of them meet the IE criteria based on their medical records. And we know that we'll probably capture, you know, X percent of that and that's how many we'll bring and then times 50 sites and you have your enrollment. Prospective recruitment is the idea of finding people who haven't necessarily been identified and getting them to raise their hands. So introducing the idea of research. And I think historically, you know, you had newspaper ads, magazine, radio, TV, that stuff still exists and it's still potentially effective. We don't do any of that. We focus exclusively on digital channels. And so if you go to any patient recruitment company's website, they, one of the first things is like 86% of trials fail to enroll on time. 50% of sites enroll 1 or 0 patients and it's broken. So it's broken. It's never been fixed. To my knowledge, none of the patient recruitment companies have more than like a 5% market share, which in a mature industry just basically says no one's figured it out. And part of that's because it's really complex. Like there's a degree to which we need the all hands on deck approach. So there's folks like us doing prospective recruitment. There's the sites using their databases. And now there's all companies saying they're going to mine EHR data, use AI to kind of scrape either payer data or health records and find matches and then reach out to those people. Sometimes you need it all and sometimes you just really don't. And I guess our role, we view ourselves as either able to fully enroll studies or to supplement enrollment really strongly by just finding folks where they are. Like people are on the internet. And so the difference is I see a lot of study ads because I click on them. And so these advertising platforms, like
you know, then fall into their funnel.
Yeah. If you click on a mattress ad, you are seeing nothing but mattress ads for the next month because those people are really good jobs and they need to sell freaking mattresses. Same way, if you start clicking on some of these patient recruitment ads, you're going to see a ton more. And so I see hundreds per week, and they all kind of fit that same mold. It's like a screen, it's like a stock photo of a doctor, some sort of like, hey, we're looking for people with blank. And it just, I don't know, it's not very compelling. And even if your message is good, if people won't stop scrolling, then it's very hard to tell them your message. So one of the things we're bringing to the table, I think, is just a more digitally native understanding, especially since a lot of us have e-commerce backgrounds where people don't stop and click and buy the product. You don't have a company. So you have to figure out how to communicate on these channels effectively. And not just, it's not just getting a message out. It's really getting someone to take action, to say yes to your thing, to say yes to leaving the platform. Like they didn't open Instagram to learn more about their migraine. They open Instagram to like watch recipes or see fitness or watch stand up. And so you're interrupting their process. It's got to be really compelling to take them away.
I see. Well, look, but perhaps that's why you're a fan of the memes for the pattern interrupt and to, yeah, try and draw a little bit of a attention there. Look, it sounds like it must be a tough gig because I'm assuming that obviously different CROs focus in different therapeutic areas, there's different diseases and symptoms, etc., that you're targeting. Do you find that the ads across the board have to vary depending on that therapeutic need, or how does it work? I mean, it's something I can't even get my head around because marketing, digital marketing in itself can be a minefield. Stopping the scroll, having that call to action correct. But then when you throw in the complexities that come with clinical research and the therapeutic focus, how do you put that in compartments as a business, or do you?
I'm going to give you an answer. I think it's the question that you're answering or that you're asking. So we start every campaign with just kind of our own digital feasibility. In the same way that a site would do, we just take the population and the prevalence of a condition and drill down into how many people we think are really in the audience. So if it's an older population, 65 and up in the US, only 3/4 of them are daily internet users. So we have to reduce the number of available people by 25% to align with reality. But in terms of what type of messaging and images really are evocative for people, we found that images just need to be standout-ish. They don't necessarily need to have any connection, even abstractly, with the TA. So a lot of the standard imagery is either that doctor I mentioned earlier, or there's a lot of like animated, if you have a knee problem, it's like osteoarthritis of the knee, and it's a picture of a knee, and you're like, okay, I get it. Like, that's what a knee looks like. But that works for some people, and for some people it doesn't. So for us, really, it's not necessarily about hitting a home run and finding one perfect image. The best image I've ever seen is not from us. It's from HavaxPhase. I don't know. They're like a really high quality, high concept branding agency that does some clinical trial recruitment. They have a really great image. It was clearly a photo shoot. This guy is being swallowed by balloons that say COPD, and he's like falling down the stairs. And fantastic, very compelling. Stopped as soon as I saw it, and I was like, screenshot, this is the best thing I've ever seen. But when you go into Facebook Ad Manager, you can see what ads are people are running, and they're only running that one image. So like, even if it is the greatest image I've ever seen, which I for clinical study recruitment it is, that's not going to get everyone. And once you see it two or three times and you've scrolled past it, like, you're done. Facebook's not going to show it to you anymore because you've reached a saturation point. So for us, the goal isn't to hit a home run and figure out exactly what's going to work. It's to bring enough diversity to the table in terms of imaging and messaging that we can hit singles and doubles and triples. Sorry to use baseball for a Brit,
That's all
but
right. I'm a big sports fan, so regardless
okay.
of the sport, I do not mind that at all.
So we want to connect with people, and we know that not everyone's the same. So why bank on one type of image or one type of message when we know that there's a diversity? Like, even when they study the reasons people join clinical research, there's a bunch that are kind of tied for first place. Like, some people want access to care. Some people want novel therapy. Some people want to just advance the medicine. And some people say, I'm literally in it for the compensation. So why try and pick one of those when digital marketing makes it so easy to just put all those in the field and then let the data decide? So to kind of put a pin in it, I would just say, like, our goal is to figure out how to speak the patient's language and make it a compelling offer. Because while they're not consumers per se, people are very used to making decisions about their healthcare, and this is one of a number of possible decisions. So it has to be more attractive than the alternative for them to consider it. And it's usually not presented that way. It's usually like, we need you to join our clinical study, which, like, Nike is not running any ads that say, we need people with feet to buy our shoes. Like, they're like just a picture of someone dunking or a video of someone running really fast. It's aspirational, and it makes you feel like, oh, cool, I want that. So figuring out how to speak that language and then getting it in front of as many people as possible is really kind of our MO. Some people do it differently, but that's kind of how we feel.
Fine. So it sounds like it's very, very much centered around that whole marketing piece, really, and using the data, letting the, you know, their algorithms do their thing to retarget individuals, and having that kind of cool thing. What do you find tends to work best? Is it that positive aspiration for people want to improve their health, or is it more so solve a problem? I know from kind of a job recruiter's aspect, normally people, like clients, don't use me because they think, oh my God, I really want to have an amazing recruitment experience. It's normally because they've fed up with who they're already dealing with, whether it's internally or elsewhere. And quite frankly, it, you know, anyone, so some of the clients I've taken on, anyone could call them that day and they would have changed just out of spite. Obviously you don't, you're not doing that with your own health. So I'm just conscious or interested to find out where you find the better results with your own kind of strategies.
Yeah, it's a great question. And I'll qualify this and say that things like oncology and rare disease are in an entirely different category. Like if you have mild eczema, you really might join a clinical study because you saw something on Pinterest. That's not the case if you have terminal cancer or a degenerative, you know, neurological condition. So we put those in their separate basket. I still think the internet is useful, and like so many people are there, it would be a shame not to use it. But we're talking about kind of lifestyle prevalent conditions where it's something that a patient has, but they're not aware of it 24/7. Mm-hmm. So with that being said, like if I had one message, if you were like, you can't use 20 headlines, you have to use one, knowing that IRBs look over all this stuff, or ECs, like it has to be ethical. You cannot force people and you cannot claim that it's a treatment or a cure. Mm-hmm. A message that often works with people along those lines who are fed up or who just haven't gotten the results they want from whatever standard of care is we'll go into patient communities, find out what symptom is like the most annoying.
Yeah.
And it will be like blank from blank condition can be challenging. Sometimes medication doesn't help. There might be another alternative.
Yeah.
Clinical researchers are working on it to find out now. Click to learn more. And the goal isn't to get them enrolled in the study because of the app. There's no way you can give them enough information. So
it's really just that initial interest. It's that problem, agitate, solution, learn more. You're then in that funnel, they'll either start seeing more ads, and it's a case of that consistency, as with so much in life.
Yeah. So you touched on like marketing is a big part of it. And there's a bunch of people out there who are pretty good at getting hand raisers. It's kind of what we call people who are like, oh, I'll learn more. Mm. The biggest issue I would say is not finding people, it's connecting them to studies. So in the industry, a lot of people call this the last mile problem. Mm-hmm. You can get a bunch of names on a database or on a spreadsheet, but how do you take those patients and actually get them to come to a study site to screen and to enroll? And people are solving it different ways. A lot of folks are leaning towards this concierge, like high touch. You'll call them, you'll have a nurse call them, walk through the IE. We think that's good. We want to solve it as much as possible with technology, not because we want to automate the humanity out of it, but because people are used to going at their own pace online. So if the front door is online, then the next step needs to be similarly paced, which means if I want to, I can go as far as possible at my own speed. So we like things like chatbot flows and automated scheduling when appropriate, with opt-outs towards like personal communication if they need that. So default to something that could work at 2 a.m. if someone's up and they can't sleep and they're on their phone, they see this ad, let them go as far as possible. But if people say, I'd really like to talk to someone about this, make that easy as well. So that's kind of our take is using tech to help close the last mile gap when appropriate.
Sure. And look, let's talk about the company a bit more. So you've been there 3 years. It sounds, I mean, to me, just hearing what you know already, that you perhaps know a lot more about clinical research than maybe you let on. So how did the company look when you first joined? So when Dan gave you that call and said that, Steve, do you fancy this? You've performed before. And you were quite openly saying, didn't necessarily have a plan, but was just straight in. Actually, probably before that, what was it in your head that made you think, you know what, actually, I've done this once, I'm going to do it again? Because it takes a certain individual to kind of where you had that steady job for like 10 years to then say, yeah, I'm going to up and leave. Yeah, I'm going to up and leave, and I'm going to try something new and bet on yourself. What was it? What do you think it is about your own mindset that allowed you to do that? Is it to do with that kind of Christian faith, or you know, is it something else with your upbringing? What do you think is giving you that mentality?
Honestly, like I wish I had like a really cool answer, but I would say both times I was close to desperation mode. So when I went to work for the e-commerce company, I'd been applying unsuccessfully to jobs with a master's degree for 3 months. So school ended in, June or whatever, and it was getting to be the fall, and I didn't have anything. We had two kids at the time, and my wife is a nurse practitioner, so she's pretty reasonably compensated, so we weren't struggling. But there's also that element of like, if you want to be contributing, want to be doing something, and you're not, and you can't find anyone, it starts to grind on you, and you're like, am I worth anything? I think so. I think I could bring something to the table. So when that offer came through of like, do this e-commerce thing, I didn't really put it through the traditional funnel of like, what if this company doesn't work or what if it isn't there? I was like, oh, it's something. So I just took it. And then making that second choice, I was really yearning to come back to Orlando. I'd moved up to Chicago for the acquisition. It's cold. People in the Midwest are very pleasant, but they're not very friendly in my experience. Like, so they'll smile, but they don't like invite you into their lives. So I was really lonely. We were having a hard time making friends. And when Dan called, it was just like, we did this before. Like, I just kind of took it on faith, not necessarily like Christian faith, but just that Dan knows what he's doing. He knows I have two kids. He wouldn't tell me to move across the country and take this risk if he didn't think it was like really solid. So I just kind of went for it.
And
I don't know.
how
Maybe
many
I'm
staff?
just an idiot. That's
What
also in
was
play.
the headcount at that point? I'm just trying to, yeah, almost put
Yeah.
myself in that position. You know, I've got two young kids now, so I can almost kind of appreciate like it's not an easy move to make, and it takes a strong mindset. But how many staff was the company
I
back
was employee
then?
number three.
Wow. Okay. So that I mean that takes some balls, I have to say, Steve. So look, betting on yourself, I mean, man, that's incredible. And look, how did things go in the early days? I'm guessing it was yourself, Dan, and sleeves with one other individual. Were you hard at it with, I don't know, cold calling, you know, outbound marketing, using your own kind of digital marketing expertise to win new clients? Because I guess just with studies, no patience. No, you know, a new business with no clients, there is nothing. So how did that look? How did you go about generating those early deals?
Yeah. So I think mostly through dumb luck, closed something my first week before I even like understood what clinical trials were, through just cold email, like outreach. And I think we were just saying enough that sounded appealing. And I think some people get to the end of their rope and they're just willing to try something different. So not being a known entity at the time was sometimes acting in our favor. But the biggest piece for us is that we were connected to a company called Avio Health. They're a DCT provider in the space. Some of the people on One in Health's board were also on Avio's board. And so they referred us to someone. Somehow we got this meeting at IQVIA, which is like obviously one of the motherships of clinical research. So I'd been on the job for 6 weeks. Dan and I flew from Florida to Raleigh for a day trip, which made me feel like a proper businessman. Like I'm flying for a day trip.
Were you floral shirt on the day, or were you?
Yeah, no. So this has been the Hawaiian shirts have been my professional uniform for about 7 years.
Yeah, nice.
We could talk about that if you want, but we flew in. We went to this meeting. We really probably had no business being there, and we pitched them One in Health, and they were like, "Sure, we'll let you know." And it didn't feel like awesome. And then about a week later, they called us and said, we have a client that it's really hard. We can't do anything. We've been recruiting online. It's not working. One of the things you said in the meeting was that even if other people aren't delivering, you can deliver because of the way you're approaching this. Prove it. And normally our contracts are like not time bound. It's just we will deliver these people until the study's full. They said you can have 1 week. You can recruit for 1 week and we'll let you know. And we had to take it because it was through IQVIA and the client's really well known. And so we started recruiting. After 2 days, they were like, all right, you got till the end of the month. By the second week, they said, all right, we're going to centralize this across all the study sites. Wow. Yeah, it was bananas. Like, it worked so well. And
how
so
did that, I mean, how did that feel? You know, you and the team must have just been sitting there going, yeah.
We were high-fiving all day, every day. Like, every time someone came through as a lead, we were just like, yes. Yeah. So the only reason they didn't fill the study is because they canceled, well, they paused it due to COVID. But we took a study that was like 90% behind pace and got it like right on the doorstep of being fully enrolled before they canceled it. And so that one win kind of catapulted us. So we got a lot more work through IQVIA.
Incredible. And
using that as a case study and then getting shots on goal with other people. And now we've kind of pivoted. Our main focus now is on biotechs, because they're small and they don't have as many rules about going through 17 layers of corporate approval on the brand, on the images and stuff. So
yeah,
it's been a wild ride.
Wow. Incredible stuff. I mean, I can only imagine like when you land like new contracts like that, you know, as a small business, that feeling of just like, you know, oh my God, this is happening. Like, this is really going. I mean, looking back on it now and perhaps, you know, bringing back those feelings, is that maybe one of the biggest successes that you've had, or have there been others that have topped that since then?
I think because it was so early and we didn't have any of those wins under our belt, that probably in terms of like the most brain chemicals getting released in the bloodstream was probably it. We have had some like bigger wins since then. But yeah, that one happening so early, like, just weeks into the job and it being such a substantial thing, it was huge.
Fine. Well, look, I guess I can't just highlight the successes. I'm sure with any business that there's also challenges along the way. If you could think back over the past kind of 3 and a bit years, what have been the toughest times, the biggest challenges that you perhaps had to overcome?
Yeah, sure.
Whether it's actually been personally doing the job or as a company on the whole.
Yeah. I mean, so just candidly, like, I still don't know if I know what I'm doing. Like, there's a lot of days where I'm like, Dan, you should just hire a proper like VP of marketing who knows how to do this stuff, because I'm really good at talking to people and I think I'm pretty persuasive at explaining this whole concept and making it concrete, but like the systems and the processes, like I'm still Googling that stuff.
Likewise, like, Steve, there's not a day goes past where I don't have to Google something about clinical research.
Yeah.
It's crazy, isn't it?
I feel like I know more about clinical research. I'm talking about, I'm Googling like my job function. Like, what are some ways to generate leads? But I'm not joking. Like, we've had enough success that it hasn't like submarined me, but
say that you need to stay current, keeping up to those with those Google searches is going to keep you current, right?
Yeah, that's fair. I just always feel like, you know, and some of it's imposter syndrome, that there could be, we could be more, like, instead of 2xing, we could be 5xing if there was someone competent driving the bus or whatever. And that's my own, you know, issues. But I think that feeling has been the biggest struggle for me. It's just, and it rears its head every, like, you know, 6 months or so, just feeling like I really don't belong. And maybe that never goes away. Maybe certain people are wired to just always feel that. But professionally, I think our biggest problem is we get really excited and think that things are going to be as easy as comparable things. So like that study I told you about, I mean, it was legitimately easy. Like we were just looking around the room, like, why do people think this is hard? And I think it just, you know, we probably wouldn't be able to put our finger on all the variables. For whatever reason, it worked, but not every study is easy. So we've taken on studies where we thought we would be able to deliver and we've had to turn around and say, no. I think our hit rate is way higher than our misses. But every single miss just feels like a dagger. So looking around the room and being like, this isn't going well, or we're losing money on this. Like we're paying $1,000 to get one person, and our compensation for that is 200. I don't have an MBA, but it doesn't add up. So figuring out like what to do when things go sideways. I know that's very general. I mean, I can tell you a specific example of feeling horrible if that's helpful, but just in general, it's when we overpromise by accident. We don't do it on purpose. Like we've never sandbagged them and like, it's easy, we got it. It's just more, it's hard to know how people are going to respond and what's going to happen when it's real.
Yeah, no, look, I get it. I mean, and with anything that involves marketing, you're constantly testing, aren't you? You know, some things work, some things don't. So look, since the beginning then, you know, where was the three of you, those big highs of winning, you know, very nice deals like that, how are things now going? How were you impacted by COVID?
Yeah, I mean, it feels a little bit rearview mirror-y at this point. And some of that's, I'm in Florida. I don't know how much you know about the COVID landscape in America, but Florida chose not to
COVID
participate.
didn't exist in Florida, did it?
Yeah, it was just kind of like guns blazing, like cursory glance towards the mask aisle and then just full steam ahead. Anyways, I think we were like, oh, maybe we won't have a business because that one study we were working on, that big one, they canceled it due to COVID. And so our primary source of revenue was gone overnight. And for about a month, we were just like, what do we do? And then the phone just started ringing off the hook as everyone started reimagining their studies as decentralized. And if you're not using a site or now that you can tap the whole internet, there's some appeal to having someone who's an expert at tapping the whole internet. And so it, you know, unfortunately for the world, but fortunately for us, was a bit of a boon, honestly. As some of those dollars and some of that mindset shift towards how do we find patients on the internet. So that was actually really helpful. And yeah, we've grown the team. I think we're, I don't know, like 26 people ish now, which I don't know, growth rates and startups or anything. We haven't taken on any money, which is probably helped us grow at a more natural pace than something exponential.
And so, I mean, how's the dynamic now? I'm guessing that you're working remotely, but now that there's 26 of you, is there an office, or are you guys all kind of remote workers?
Yeah, so we kept our office through February of 22, and we were splitting it with two other startups, and they never came back. So there was like 10 of us in an office for 40 people. It felt very weird. And then they just decided, they were like, we're breaking our lease. We're not paying the rent anymore. And we're like, well, we're not going to pay the whole thing. So we went remote way later than a lot of other people. We held on as long as we could because Dan and I are both, I just love being around people. I deeply hate the remote work life. I understand it's convenient in a number of ways, but I start to get a little stir crazy and I don't love it. So yeah, we're fully remote now. And it's funny, we're going to the Dominican Republic tomorrow as a company for a
Nice.
retreat because we noticed that like our Orlando office, which is where we started, the people who were together have kind of a different cultural feel than the folks who've been hired on remotely and distributed. And we want to try and not just like have this web-based only culture. Like we want to sit in the same room and like laugh together and share some drinks and stories. And I think we're doing like a ATV excursion. So maybe someone will get thrown off an ATV. No, maybe not that risky. Maybe they'll just I don't know, whatever.
But
But yeah,
it should
so
be good to get together as a team. As you say, if you're a people person, you know, getting out and having a few cocktails over in the Dominican is going to be very nice indeed, I can imagine.
yeah, and so since we're not paying rent for an office, like we're just kind of putting most of that money towards having a pretty good experience as a company.
Awesome stuff. Well, I mean, you spoke kind of a few minutes ago about that perhaps imposter syndrome, and that being one of the, you know, the struggles or challenges that you faced. There may be some interesting lives that I'm planning coming up soon that I'm sure will be of interest to yourself talking about that subject. But what else have you learned about yourself? Because it must have been one hell of a journey to kind of take that leap, make a success of it, go from three people to 26 to now tomorrow heading off to Dominican for a, you know, a team get together. What have you learned about yourself along the way, Steve?
I'll give you one negative and then I'll try to think of a positive. I'm like pretty pessimistic when it comes to self-assessment. So my initial reaction is to go negative, but I would say I do not have a great work ethic. So unless something is like really in my mind and really exciting to me, it's very hard for me to work on stuff. And I know people are like, oh yeah, we all have stuff we don't like to do. Like literally I would just not do it. And I have to either have systems in place or some sort of like hardcore accountability to get the stuff done that's not in my mind. The counter side of that is that when I'm super engaged, work doesn't feel like work. So I've found that, my ability to like problem solve and think differently and really communicate has grown a lot during this role, because it really is all about how do you take a message. Like the first thing we ever hear from anyone is, well, what makes you different from XYZ other company?
Yeah.
And so figuring out how to, I don't know, get in front of pharmaceutical executives and communicate a somewhat nuanced truth about digital marketing, which is kind of at the core of how we're different, in a short amount of time has been really good. So all that say, I would say the thing I've learned negative is that I really don't have a great work ethic, even though I'm a hard worker. Like I'll be thinking about something in the shower and then like go and work on a slide deck at like 10 o'clock at night because I'm consumed by it. But then during the work hours, I'm like just clicking the mouse, like wishing that the time would go by faster. And then on the other side, I think I've discovered some untapped horsepower in the creativity and communication department.
Awesome stuff. And look, I guess just out of pure curiosity, look, it's a very broad question. I almost hate it when people ask me the whole, what makes you different? Because I'm like, you talk about our pricing, our processes, you know, there's a million and one things. And I'm like, could you please clarify that? But that if you were to kind of pick your favorite one that differentiates, you know, 1N Health from others, is there kind of a particular USP, or is it just results? What would you, if there was kind of one that you almost, if you were to play top trumps and say, okay, look, this is where everyone else falls down, this is where we're good, what perhaps would be that differentiator?
Yeah, so we just had an offsite, just the business development folks to try and get to this and come up with something coherent. And I wish it was like fully workshopped out, but you mentioned results. That's usually where we go when someone asks that question, because we do tend to deliver different results. But I would say we're distilling it to something like, our philosophy helps us not waste the power of the internet.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I think it is being wasted in a lot of instances.
Got ya. Well, I'm now going to be tuning in to see more. Hopefully, I'll see some pics on LinkedIn from this this trip that you've got. But I'll certainly be following what it's about. And I know that myself often I get questions about patient recruitment. Do I know anyone and things? So I can certainly start routing perhaps some people your way. But in terms of plans for the business over the next 6 months or a year, is there kind of more growth plans? Is it going to stay organic? Are you going to stay remote? Is there going to be any other, you know, kind of change of direction for at your end, or is it going to be, you know, kind of doubling down and more of the same and all organic?
So we're going to stay remote. We're going to grow. I don't think we've not had an open rec since the first half of 2022. Like, we're always hiring, which is great. We do plan to introduce something new into the ecosystem in the second half of the year. It's live now. We're using it on our studies, but we're not really talking about it a ton. And it's basically just the platform that we've built to kind of power our studies. Like, when we first started, we were honestly using like HubSpot and Google Sheets, which is the most duct tape and glue. Like, it's only compliant if you squint your eyes and like just glance really quick. And so we knew really quickly we either had to find something off the shelf or build something custom, and brought in a fantastic CTO named Nikishi Muhammad. She was a friend of Dan's from the e-commerce world, built some SaaS products that we actually used in our e-commerce business. And we were like, hey, you're really good at this. What do you think about it? And so she joined us, and yeah, we're really excited. We think that because we think about things differently, we think we're going to bring something to the table that people are just not expecting in terms of what you can do with the data that's being generated by all these patients coming through these funnels. It's really powerful. And I know that's a lame answer to be like, we have this secret thing, but I don't want to like spill the beans just yet, but
the marketer in you, that Steve, isn't it? It's like, oh, you know, show you behind the curtain when the time's right. Everyone will have to, you know, tune in and keep following this to, you know, find out more about the journey. But look, before I let you go, Steve, we always close up the show with a quick fire questions round. So I'll hit you with the first one. Take you back to your younger self and say, look, what would be the one piece of advice that you would give that man?
Yeah. Aside from like, you know, buy Amazon in 1997, like, I think I would encourage myself to document my life a little bit better. I don't have a great memory, and I know there's all these things that happen. Like, I don't have photos. I don't have personal journals. I know I've grown as a person, but I don't have a record of that. My wife has been keeping a journal since she was like 13, and wow, she can go and be like, I remember I was thinking through this when I was in college, and then I thought through it again in my 30s, and like, here's the way I was thinking differently. So just documenting and like having some connection to the past beyond my own mind, that's one of the things I wish I had and I don't.
Cool. We've not had that one on the show before, but I think it's a good one. And look, on to my next question, and that is about books or resources. What book or resource would you perhaps recommend for our audience?
Sure. I would just say the resource that is all the books. So if you live in the US, I don't know what it's like across the old pond, but your library has an app that allows you to get audiobooks or books on your Kindle for free. You just get them and you don't have to worry about buying them, taking up space in your home. If you're like, I must have a physical book, they will ship it to your house for free. Libraries are fantastic and vastly underutilized, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. I am a big advocate of being a learner. And so rather than tell someone a book that they may or may not enjoy, I would just say get the app for your local library and read some stuff.
I'll have to check that out, actually. I mean, I'm a big Audible man myself. I flip through books quite a bit. So I like that one. I guess the next question, we often talk a lot about work and people's career journeys on this show. But outside of work, we've all got lives, families, etc. I saw a while back that you had taken the kids to a donut shop early morning after not getting them to an appointment. But look, what is the favorite thing for yourself outside of work, Steve?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I like lose my parenting card if I don't say it's hanging out with my kids, which it's fun. Obviously, as a parent, you know, that can grind on you. So if it's me and I'm alone, I'm running. Like, I like to run. Training for something or just going out for a jog and clearing my mind is how I use most of the free time that I have, which is not a ton.
Cool. And look, finally, a bit of a deeper one here, but what is your golden, or your number one, should I say, golden rule for both life and business?
Yeah, it's challenging. I've heard you ask this question before, and I tried to put some thought into it, although I want to appear very off the cuff, James. and I think it's challenging because like something that works for business like might not be a great life rule and vice versa. So I think for me, it's cultivate curiosity. I think it prevents you from being an a-hole, helps you gain skills. I think a big problem for a lot of us is self-obsession, whether that's positive or negative, comparing yourself to other people or just feeling proud and curiosity about other people, about processes, about other things, really cures a lot of that, or is at least reduces some of the symptoms. So finding out ways to cultivate curiosity if you're not already naturally curious is the number one thing I tell my kids all the time. So I'll go with that.
Cool. Well, look, Steve, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. As I say, I'm sure you're now going to be heading off to enjoy your trip. But look, for anyone that wants to reach out to you, find out more about 1N Health. If there's anyone in the market for Hawaiian shirts and needs a recommendation, what is the best way to get hold of you and or the business?
I mean, most people say LinkedIn, so I'll just go with that. I wanted to be like some obscure like MySpace or something like that. But yeah, LinkedIn is the easiest. I'm on there a lot, and it's really, I'll get the message. If you call me, I don't have voicemail set up, so I'll never hear the message. Awesome
stuff. Perfect. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure, Steve. Thanks again for joining me, and no doubt we will speak soon.
Yeah, absolutely. Appreciate it, James. Cheers.
All right, cheers.